Barbara Bradley Haggerty is National Public Radio's religion reporter. She's also a practicing Christian, though over the years she found herself wondering if her faith could really stand up to the latest scientific discoveries about the brain. So she went on a personal odyssey of sorts, interviewing mystics, skeptics, and a wide range of scientists, and wrote a book about what she found called Fingerprints of God. Haggerty told Steve Paulson that a very strange experience launched her on this quest.
Back in 1995, I was doing a story for the LA Times Sunday magazine, and it was why some churches grow and other churches don't grow. And I was talking to people about their spiritual journey, and one woman I was talking to was named Kathy Young. It was nighttime, it was after the Saturday night service, and we're sitting outside under a street lamp, and she was talking to me about her faith, and she mentioned that the melanoma that she had actually returned, but that she didn't see this return of the melanoma as an attempt by God to kill her, but to give her a transcendent purpose. And I got to tell you that it was a really powerful statement. And as she continued to talk about her spiritual journey, something really, really strange happened, Steve. It was as if someone stepped inside the circle of light that we were sitting in and began to breathe on us. You know, the air grew moist and warm, as if there was someone breathing. And it wasn't just me that noticed this. She was mid-sentence, and she just stopped talking. And we both sat there for about 30 seconds, 60 seconds maybe, feeling this atmosphere change. And then it receded and went away, and I was incredibly spooked. So I shut down the interview. I said, thanks a lot. Talk to you later. And drove back to LA. But the recurring question I had, the one that haunted me, was I crazy? Was that just brain chemistry? Or was it possible that somehow we had kind of tapped into a spiritual reality? Or put in kind of simpler terms, is there a God who can breathe on you, who occasionally intervenes and pierces through this veil of reality that we believe in? And so, you know, it was really that story, that mystical experience that launched me on this journey and made me ask all the big questions.
Now, how did you approach this subject? Because I know, as you write about in your book, you come from a background of religious faith. Mm-hmm. Did that help shape your inquiry into these questions, or did you come at it really open to finding just about anything?
Well, you know, you want to think, as a journalist, you want to think, of course, that you're completely unbiased. But, of course, our worldviews and our experiences shape us, right? And because I did come from a Christian Science background where we seem to see, at least, the power of prayer on our bodies, healings and things like that, because of that, you know, I was open to spiritual experience. I was kind of hoping that God isn't a ruse. Now, I was open to the idea that maybe it would turn out that science would show it's all brain chemistry. Every spiritual experience we have is brain chemistry. And that, you know, some people are just genetically wired toward transcendent experiences, just as they're more wired toward, say, being artists or something like that. That this was just a physical phenomenon. I was open to that. I was afraid that I might find that. But what I eventually found is that science is kind of actually agnostic on the issue. That science can't say whether there is a God or isn't a God. Both conclusions are plausible.
Now, you talked to a lot of people who reported having mystical experiences, and some of those compelling stories you write about are what we would commonly call near-death experiences, and you've given us some snippets of interviews that you recorded, and I want to play one of these with a man named Edward Salisbury, who was in a bad car wreck many years ago.
As I was driving, I hit the curb, and it was sort of a sudden shock. And the next thing I know is a big bang, like you get hit from a swinging door from behind, totally surprised. The next thing I felt was seeing that tree and merging, actually literally becoming one with that tree. I felt myself flow in as if going through the arteries of the tree up to the top leaf and popping out. And as I looked around, it was like I was looking off a balcony, and I said, that car looks like mine. But it was, you know, it's crashed, it's burning, people running out of the house. I looked a little closer, and there's this body slumped over the steering wheel. And I had to think, and I said, that's my body. If that's my body, then, you know, who am I?
Okay. What do you make of that story?
Well, first I should say that I interviewed a whole lot of people who had had near-death experiences, and I heard this kind of thing over and over and over again. What I have to say about near-death experiences is I don't know if they're real or not. And the reason I say that is because I think near-death experiences are explainable through material means. I mean, I think you can make a plausible argument that this is what a brain does when it's oxygen deprived or when it's, you know, has sudden trauma, when it's shutting down, that it steals memories from the hippocampus and it hears voices and creates delusions or illusions. Mm-hmm. So it's an open question.
Let's hear another bit of an interview that you did with someone else who had a near-death experience. Pam Reynolds is her name. She had had brain surgery for an aneurysm and was in a deep coma, according to her doctor. But she says that during the surgery, she was aware of what was going on. In fact, she heard sounds, even music.
And as the sound continued, I don't know how to explain this other than go ahead and say it, I popped out of the top of my head. And I could feel like a suction cup at the top of my head popping. And then I was looking down at the body. I knew it was my body. And again, an odd thing. I didn't care. It was wonderful. Colors were brighter. Sounds were more intense. It was as if every sense that I'd ever known were perfect.
And didn't you talk to her doctors after this had happened, and who said that, I mean, basically corroborated her account, and they said there's no way she should have been able to hear or be aware of any of this because she was in a coma?
Absolutely. They did say that. Her neurosurgeon said he had no scientific explanation for this, and it actually changed his view of reality. It had to make him rethink his kind of more material view of reality. You know, Steve, what is fascinating about the Pam Reynolds case to me is not the near-death experience, but the clip you just played, which is the out-of-body experience, because she raises, I think, a really fascinating question, and that is, can consciousness or the mind operate when the brain seems to be not functioning well? For example, if we had listened a little bit further, what we would have heard her say is that her eyes were taped shut. Her ears had clickers in them that were sounding as loud as a jet plane taking off 90 to 100 decibels, and that was so they could measure the brainstem activity so that they could actually lower body temperature and drain the blood out of her head, which you don't want to do when you have brainstem activity. She was also in this deep coma. And yet she saw and heard things that would be very difficult to see or hear. She saw what the operating room looked like. She saw what the Midas Rex bone saw looked like. She said it looked like an electric toothbrush. She could describe the drill bits. She heard conversations. She heard one surgeon say, gosh, her left femoral vein is too small, and another say, well, then try her right vein. And she saw the resuscitation. So she seemed to see things and accurately report things that really she had no business seeing or hearing, because she supposedly could not perceive anything, her eyes being taped shut and her ears, you know, being clogged and being in a coma. Now, this raises the question, could her consciousness be operating? What one doctor told me is, one who didn't believe that this was any particularly special story, he said, you know, it could have been that the earplugs were loose and she could have heard conversations. She was awakened. She had anesthesia awareness. She was awakened and she could hear things, and therefore she could create a picture in her mind of all that was going on.
Mm-hmm. Well, in fact, I have queued up a bit of a tape from one of these skeptics, an Australian anesthesiologist, Gerald Worley.
That's right.
Who thinks these kinds of stories are rubbish. I mean, delightful rubbish, but still, I mean, they don't really suggest out-of-body experiences or near-death experiences or anything like that.
In my opinion, their consciousness has absolutely not left their brain. What they are experiencing is a wonderful illusion generated by the functioning of their body. Heart massage is always applied during a cardiac arrest. And what does heart massage do? It's a method of causing a pumping action of the heart so that blood is circulated around the body. And while they're conscious, they can hear and they can see. One of my colleagues in a hospital nearby does experiments with oxygen starvation. And he says, these people, they feel fantastic.
So he's saying it's just a physiological reaction to radical changes that are going on inside the body and also the brain. That's what explains these remarkable experiences.
Absolutely. And you know what? That could explain all of these experiences. It could explain every out-of-body experience. The interesting thing, the reason I focused on Pam Reynolds is because, A, her account is corroborated. Now, of course, Gerald Worley could be completely right. You know, we don't know. We really don't know. I just think that her case is one of the more interesting ones to raise the question about the nature of consciousness.
And this is really one of the underlying questions in this whole debate. I mean, this gets at the question of whether the mind is just the brain. I mean, the physical mechanics of the brain, or whether there's some dimension of the mind that goes beyond the brain. And a lot rides on how you answer that question.
That's right. And, you know, this is not a question that's at the margins. This is a really, really robust debate right now in neuroscience. I mean, this isn't just people who are studying near-death experiences who have this question. Neurologists everywhere are wondering if consciousness is an emergent property of the brain or if it's just in the brain. And so a case like Pam Reynolds might contribute to the debate, but it certainly doesn't define the debate. This is a raging debate right now. And I don't know, you know, I don't know when they're going to answer the question, but big minds are thinking about this stuff.
So you've interviewed a lot of these people, scientists as well as people who report these experiences. Have you come to any conclusions yourself?
What I ended up concluding in terms of the way I think about God or spiritual reality or whatever you want to call it is that there's a plausible case to be made that there is such a thing as spiritual reality. And you know what? I'm not kind of alone in this. A lot of people, but a lot of really smart people, believed the same thing. I mean, Albert Einstein talked about God as an infinite intelligence. You know, the intelligence.
But he also didn't believe that God actually intervened in the physical world.
Absolutely. A God that I could defend, say, at a cocktail party or with a scientist friend would not be a personal God that intervenes, that breaks the laws of nature. I think not a lot of people who are scientists would be convinced of that God. However, a God that I think might be more plausible, one that scientists could believe in, is this notion of an infinite intelligence that created the universe, that geared it toward life. Freeman Dyson talks about it's as if the universe knew we were coming, that the universe seems to be so finely tuned toward life that a lot of people don't think it's random. And a God perhaps that crafted our genes and our brains to be able to perceive that kind of God. That's not an interventionist God. For me, I think it's plausible when you look at the extraordinary wirings of our brain and how common these spiritual experiences are to think that maybe it's not just mass delusion. You know, 51% of people have said they have had a transcendent experience that absolutely transformed their lives. There was a before and an after. They could circle it on a calendar. Maybe 51% of Americans are crazy. But maybe not. Maybe they're just human. And maybe this is part of the human condition that on occasion we are able to tap into, to connect with a reality that we might not be able to measure, but we can feel. And that leaves evidence of itself, both in our brains and our bodies, but also in the way we view the world.
That's NPR's religion reporter Barbara Bradley Haggerty talking with Steve Paulson. Her book is called Fingerprints of God.